The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
It was an old football manager who once said, football isn't a matter of life and death, it's more important than that. But I think our next guest, who comes from rugby, Mike Ross, the former Leinster and Ireland prop forward, has a more considered, mature view, I think, than that, which comes across in his autobiography, Dark Arts. Mike Ross, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
There's some really personal stories in here that go beyond sport. And the one that I want to start with is how your wife nearly died and you continued to train and play rugby for Ireland while she was in hospital. I know that sounds like a very desperately harsh story to start with.
Yeah.
But you actually address it in a very mature fashion in retrospect. Tell us about it.
It was our first child around about February 2011. And we played the French the week before. And Kevin was a very considerate baby. He decided he'd arrive on the down week, you know, the fallow week of the Six Nations. So we're in the taxi, got to the hospital. Things were progressing well. They'd put a heart rate monitor on his head. It was all going very well. And then suddenly his heart rate dropped. And I was thrown out of the room in about 30 seconds. And team all came in and Kim had to have an emergency C-section. He came out. I was taken a bit aback because I was expecting my wife to be telling me what to do because I wouldn't have had a lot of experience with children at that stage. So they handed me this baby. Of course, he immediately whittled on me.
As they do.
And then they wrap him up and clothe him. And of course, my wife was out of it because it wasn't, it was just a quick knock her out and get the baby out. And a couple hours later, Kim was out of recovery and she got to meet the baby. And finally, he got fed. That was fine.
Everything going all right.
The following evening, she had a bit of abdominal pain and was a bit concerned over that, but you know, she had a cesarean, you know, a bit of abdominal pain was to be expected. And then I came back on the Monday after training and she was bloated. You know, she was looking like, you know, there's something going on. So they took her down for an X-ray. Next thing you know, she's been taken off to the matter. Now, she couldn't bring Kevin with her, you know, so we had a newborn baby and there's no facilities to hold him at the matter. So he ended up going into the NIC to be looked after. She was there for a couple of days and they thought she had some kind of pressure gas buildup. And they tried treating that a couple of times. They used a decompression procedure. But it wasn't working. Kim said, like, I'll go back to training because this is the week of the Scotland match.
So you were heading off to Carton House or somewhere like that, is it?
I think it was...
Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, Fitzpatrick. Yeah, Killiney, okay. Yeah.
But you're leaving her bedside to go training, yeah. Prepare for a rugby match at the weekend.
Yeah, no, we had a very good friend come up and stay with us and she was keeping an eye on her. But at the same time, so I'm leaving training, I'm going back to the rotunda, then I'm going over to see Kim, and then I'm going back to the hotel, you know, and they're telling me, oh, look, it'll be fine. Sometimes this happens and it'll resolve itself. I think it was Wednesday, I called up a good friend of mine, and he's since left us, the late, great Arthur Tanner. I said to the prof, I said, I'm not happy about this, you know, there's something wrong here. And he said he'd put a few calls in and find out what was going on, and I think they called me back that afternoon and said, oh, look, we're hoping this charger tomorrow, you know, things are picking up. And that was okay. And then I get the call, she's gone to surgery, come in now. So what happened was they're taking her down for another CT scan. And while she was there, she started to crash. Her organs started to shut down, basically. She had a massive infection. And her life was saved by Anne Brannigan, who's a surgeon inside in the matter. So Anne just took her straight into surgery, opened her up, and there was about 3 or 4 feet of necrotic intestine about to rupture. And
what does that mean?
Basically, she developed what they call toxic megacolon. So your gut stops working. They thought afterwards maybe it was down to the use of opioids, because that sometimes is a reaction to opioids, your intestines stop working. But basically, the blood supply had been cut off and the intestine was about, it was like having a massive appendix about to go off. So they removed that, fish her back up, and they put her into the high dependency unit.
So you must have been in shock dealing with all this.
I was waiting for a couple hours to see what was going to happen.
And this was on the Wednesday?
The Wednesday or the Thursday.
But you're due to fly out to Scotland.
I'm due to fly out to Scotland, yeah.
So I think in retrospect, you probably think, and many people listening say, well, look, it's only a rugby match at the weekend. I'm staying with my wife and newborn child. And yet you were persuaded to go to Scotland.
Yeah,
because was there anyone else putting you under pressure to go?
No, it was my wife. She came out of the surgery, right? And the first thing she says to me, I want you to go to Scotland.
Maybe that was the effects, the after effects of the medication.
I'm thinking so, because she was telling me afterwards that she thought she was in a hotel room. You know, the after effects of the anesthesia were wearing off.
She didn't fully understand the seriousness of what had nearly happened.
Probably not, you know, but it was a strange one. But at the same time, I suppose that's kind of the message I wanted to hear too, you know. I mean, like, her irons were over. My mum was with our son and she was being looked after, and I'd just be hanging around. She said, no, go play, secure our family's future.
You're focused to go and play.
I don't focus, right? But like, I'm not averse to hearing that message, you know. Like, I'd just broken into the team.
And were you afraid that if you didn't go and play that you'd lose your place in the team and then you sort of go backwards, because you were sort of a late developer in your career?
I don't know. I think I was just actually glad for the distraction, to be honest.
And then when you did go and play and Ireland won the game, I mean, were you happy with yourself or did you get consumed by guilt?
I'd say the guilt hit a bit afterwards. Yeah, I know. I went into House of Fraser in Edinburgh and I spent about 200 quid on baby clothes. And my wife was just laughing at me when I got back, because she said, Kevin's going to be grown out of these in like 2 months. Yeah, so I was a designer baby clothes, because I, of course, I was clueless. I just wanted to do something.
At what stage did you realise that you probably shouldn't have gone?
I suppose a few weeks afterwards, I was thinking back to myself, what the hell was I doing? You know,
But did nobody else turn around to you, not fellow players or Declan Kidney as coach or anyone else, and think and say, listen, Mike, actually, you know, really, you should be back at home? Or is it that everyone gets so caught up in the need to win a match that everybody turns up unless they're physically unable to play?
I did have the option. I think Decky said, look, if you want to stand down, but my wife telling me go and play. And
but does it mean now that when you finish your career and you're retired from rugby after winning multiple Heineken Cups with Leinster, having won so many Six Nations titles with Ireland, do you look back on it all differently now and start to see that what might have consumed you was still just a pastime, a sort of a spectator sport rather than something that is a life or death issue?
Yeah, I mean, rugby, when you're in it, it's a bubble, and all the boys know it's a bubble. But at the same time, it's a bubble that takes over every aspect of your life. I mean, you go on holiday, you're not really enjoying yourself as much as you could, because, you know, you've got, well, certainly in my case anyway, because I would have things like DEXA scans waiting for me.
And what's that?
So see how much fat you've gained while you've been away. You know, fitness testing, and you get 2 weeks off, but then you get 4 weeks off total, but the first 2 weeks you can take completely off, but the next 2 weeks you start getting prepared to go back the most physically demanding part of the season, which is always seemed a bit weird to me, that you'd have finish what might be a 52-week season, take 4 weeks off, and then pretend it never happened and do it all over again.
Another thing, which of course, which is in the book as well, and we have spoken many years ago about this, but I was also taken by when you went to write about your brother who died by suicide back in the 1990s. He was only 16 years of age. You discovered in preparation for this book that he had left a note, which you actually had not known about. How much of a shock was that to you, to actually sort of, having come through the grieving process, having moved on to a certain extent, to suddenly discover that there was this note?
It was a big shock to me, because that was kind of part of my internal story of it, that there was no note. And I suppose my mother, I kind of kept it from us. Since talking to my siblings, a couple of them actually knew about it, but it was news to me. So
why had she kept it from you?
I don't know. I hadn't really gone looking for it. I mean, like, it's not like she's going to bring it up to me and go, by the way, in case you're wondering. You know, maybe you weren't, but here it is, that she had the note. And like, I read it a couple months ago and it took me back 20 years. It was so strange, you know, just reading that, you know, and probably, like, you know, in a way it was my last ever communication with him, because it was something I hadn't seen before.
I can only imagine how traumatic it must be. You were 17, I think, at the time, weren't you? And he was 16. So you were closest in age amongst the siblings and the family. And the trauma of seeing him and of what he had did, how long does it take to actually process and deal with that?
I think it's largely, I'm still processing and dealing with it. I mean, it's been 20 years now. And time certainly is a healer. Time allows you to look at things a bit more objectively and clearly, and you know, the pain dulls down eventually. But when I was writing this book, you know, it was a bit, it nearly took me back to that time almost, because I didn't want to varnish it or sugarcoat it as to what it was and what happened and what we experienced, because I think it's important that people to realize the reality of what happens and what it leaves behind. So that was quite important to me.
What does it leave behind? I mean, how difficult is it for a family? Because everybody probably in a family has their own way of dealing with a trauma like that. But is it something that brings a family closer together, or what does it do to you?
A bit of both. It kind of leaves a trail of devastation behind it. But then, I mean, the family is left either sink or swim. And I think we swam. You know, didn't swim that well, but we swam. And it brought us together, like I say in the book, that we don't really argue anymore or have, you know, big blow-off fights. We usually, you know, realize what's happening and draw together before that occurs. So, but it kind of took us a long time to get back to a state of normality afterwards.
Yeah, because you would have been what stage? You were still in school at this time, right?
Yeah, I was just going and doing, I did the Leaving Cert. So this happened in October and I did the Leaving Cert the following June.
How tough was that to actually get through?
My concentration was wrecked for a long time after it. I found, before I used to be able to get lost in the book, and it took me a couple of years to be able to get back to doing that. So probably my schoolwork did suffer, but I'm lucky enough to have a decent natural degree of book smarts, so I was able to kind of cruise through Leaving Cert and that, but did I probably achieve as high as I could have without that sort of thing happening? Probably not. But at the same time, I got in a course I wanted to in UCC, and I went through college and I got my degree.
And of course, you came to rugby later, professional rugby. You sort of were around the edges of Munster. It didn't work out for you there. Getting your career on track later on when you're more mature, do you actually appreciate more what you get, do you think? Or do you just end up in the same bubble as everybody else?
Oh no, I definitely appreciate it. I mean, I worked in the lab for 2 years, food lab, you know, testing different food samples from microbiological contamination. So every time I ran out into the pitch for a training session, I took a good look around, and anytime I was feeling down about certain things, I reminded myself what the alternative could have been. And yeah, I loved every day of it. You know, I loved playing it, and it was very hard to kind of leave that go, but at some point, you know, it happens to us all.
Yeah, because a lot of players, just to finish, Mike Ross, author of Dark Arts, his autobiography, Mike, for a lot of players, when they finish up, they actually don't really know what to do because that bubble you've described, they've been in it for so long. Have you had that problem in switching off, or do you think perhaps are you better prepared because of all your life experiences for the end of your rugby career?
I think I was better prepared because I knew what the real world was like outside of that bubble. And so when I went into my current role, I work for a software company called Wazuda, now as a commercial director. I was a bit better prepared as to the reality of it. You know, I think one tough thing I found about transition is that my weeks and days were no longer mapped out for me, and I had to go and set my own calendar. So there was a bit of transition around that, but now I'm about 15 months into it and I'm got my feet under me and I'm starting to enjoy it.
So do you miss the rugby at all?
I miss the boys. You know, I don't miss getting cleaned out in training or fitness testing or, you know, the constant pressure to perform. I mean, because there's nothing quite like rugby pressure. In my new role, I mean, my successes and failures are my own. I'm not going to pick up the paper on Sunday and see the marks, the 9 out of 10 out of 10 or 5 or 6 as they sometimes could be.
We're going to leave it there. Mike Ross, thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on The Last Word on Today FM. The book is called Dark Arts.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.